Welcome to the AKC Podcast, an audio resource for the King's community following the Associateship of King's College programme. The AKC is an inclusive, research-led programme of lectures which explore diverse religious and cultural perspectives. For more information, visit kcl.ac.uk/AKC. Lecture resources and further reading links for this lecture are available on the AKC Keats area.
Good afternoon to you all in person and online. So indeed, we will base our reflections today on an Indian tradition, Jainism, which is, I think, far less known than its proximate others, Hinduism and Buddhism. So if you have not heard so much of about Jainism, do not worry. I will introduce what needs to be for our reflection. So to start with a very brief introduction, before we dive into the concept of the soul in Jainism. To start with, the Jains are those who follow the teaching of the Jinas. And Jina means victorious, because the liberated beings that the Jains worship, they are those who have successfully conquered their passions. So they are victorious over this conquest of their passions. But actually the Jains more usually call these beings the Tirthankara. So Tirthankara means for the maker, and the idea is that their teaching and the securing of a community of monastic and lay followers, all that creates a spiritual ford over the ocean of rebirth. And this is a shallow area in which we do not drown, and which is also a path towards liberation. So the Tirthankaras are omniscient beings, and their teaching is an expression of the eternal and essential nature of the universe. And the only extant teaching that we have, that the Jains have, is that of Mahavira. Mahavira is the very last Tirthankara of this cosmic period, the 24th one. And Mahavira means the great hero. And his traditional dates are 6th century before the Common Era. He lived in northeast India, and his biography actually is very, very close to that of the Buddha. His status also within Jainism is very close to that of the Buddha within Buddhism. So at the heart of Jainism, you have this belief that each living being, so you, me, and also, you know, that bacterium that I should be very careful not to crush while moving my hands too quickly, each of us is a permanent soul or a permanent self. So in Sanskrit, it's Atman or Jiva. And that a soul is essentially unobstructed knowledge, unobstructed perception or insight, and unobstructed energy and unobstructed bliss. No souls get embodied as elementary beings, as plants, as animals, as human beings, and also as heavenly or infernal beings. And all Jain religious practices will be directed towards overcoming the embodiment of the soul, towards this disentangling of the soul and matter, and especially a very specific type of subtle matter, which is called karmic matter, as we will see. So in this lecture, I first want to examine in more depth the relationship between the souls and karmic matter in Jainism, and from this to assess how this metaphysics affects the religious practices of the Jains, especially today, and the way Jain conceive their position, our position, and our responsibility within the world. So let us start, and let us start by focusing on the treatise on what there is, Tattvartha Sutra. The treatise on what there is associated with the name of Umasvami, and is probably composed by multiple authors around the 4th, 5th century of the Common Era. And actually it is traditionally considered as the first work and main representative work of classical Jaina philosophy. So if you want to start this, start with this work, I would advise. So it integrates a lot of themes tackled in canonical literature within a single coherent philosophical system. And it's the first work in Sanskrit also. So according to this teaching, there are six types of substances. So there are souls, jiva, and there are non-souls. And this big non-salt category is itself divided in between matter, space, medium of motion, medium of rest, and for some authors, time. So we already said that each soul is in its sense of unobstructed knowledge, perception, bliss, and energy. Now the defining characteristic of the soul is more precisely to be the operation of consciousness. And each soul is eternal. Each soul has no beginning, no end. And at the same time, each soul is constantly experiencing change. And actually, this is one of the core teachings of Jaina philosophy, that every existing thing is at the same time essentially persistent and essentially changing. Persistence and change are the two faces of the same coin. And this is what prompted Jaina philosopher. We won't see that today, but just so you have in mind, this prompted Jaina philosophers to develop a theory of knowledge able to describe what they call the many-sided reality. So each soul, continuing our definition of the soul, each soul is without part, not physical, yet it can expand, and sometimes it can even expand to the size of the whole universe. But more usually, the soul is what it's coextensive with the body it occupies, like a light in a room. And this is what explains that I have sensation from the top of my head to the tip of my toes. And finally, each soul is isolated from everything else. So there are kinds of living sentient monads. So interestingly, there is a pan-Indian conception that what has part is impermanent. Only what doesn't have part can be permanent. And whenever you have the structuration of something with parts, that structuration is doomed to, at some point, cease. So in Jainism, matter is the only type of substance that can associate or dissociate. It's the only type of substance that has parts. So impermanence that from which we suffer comes only from one's association to matter. Indeed, time has no extension. Space, medium of motion, and medium of rest also are each indivisible whole that occupies all cosmic space. And we have just said that souls are without parts. So if there are physicists in the audience, you probably have a lot to say on these early conceptions, so do not hesitate to do so in the Q&A session. This is always very interesting to see how the evolution of our understanding of the world is. So as for now, we have matter, space, medium of motion, and medium of rest. They are all substances, and they collectively form a category which is called non-self stuff. In such a way that Jainism is usually presented as a dualism between souls and whatever is not soul. So, we have said that embodied, a soul can be a human being as well as an animal, a plant, or an elemental body, like water bodies also. And now there is also a non-embodied, liberated state of the soul. So here, if you remember, if we are to take seriously the Jain claim according to which every soul should both have a type of persistence and be changing, so even the omniscient beings, the one who is liberated, the one who fully manifests the qualities of consciousness, etc., even those beings still have modal variations on their consciousness, like modes of unobstructed knowledge continuously succeeding one another. So the very last aspect of Jaina metaphysics I would like to introduce is their conception of karma. So I think we are all familiar with karma theories. So one's act in the previous life or one's previous like acts in this life engender a type of experience to be had in the future or in the next life. So part of it is a mechanical account, actually, of the formation of habits, like the ski metaphor, you know. If you are skiing following a given track, the deeper the track is due to past skiing on it, the harder it will be for you to step out of this track. So it's a bit like that. So here, one specificity of Jains is to consider karma as a type of matter, a very subtle one. And so, as you can see on this slide, there are eight types of karmic matter in Jainism. for ones which are harming ones, which are always bad, delusory karma, which reduces our innate bliss. And then you have a knowledge obstructing karma, which reduces our innate knowledge. The perception obstructing karma, which reduces our innate perception. And the obstacle karma, which reduces our innate energy. And next to this, you have four non-harming karma that can be good or bad. So the feeling one, which determines the sensation that we have now, the name karma, the life karma, the clan karma. The life karma, which will determine the duration of our current life. So we are not going to dive into this so much. The mechanisms of karma, just keep in mind that they are key to understand what happens in our lives. Good feeling karma produces pleasant feelings, bad feeling karma, painful feelings. And these types of karma actually are present as long as the soul is bound to a body, which means that the embodied soul is never, never free from potential unpleasant feelings or for potential evil embodiments. So what we really want in the long run is really to get liberated. And so the Jhana practices are directed towards this liberation. Existing in this embodied form is itself considered as a type of suffering. Even if you're not experiencing current pain, this very embodiment is itself a type of suffering. Here, suffering is not a conditioned type of feeling of pain, but it's a general dissatisfaction concerning life as conditioned. The awareness that such a life is somehow wrong. So in its pure isolated state, the soul is not characterized by feelings, nor by karma, but the soul is only characterized as liberated by its inherent qualities, and amongst which are especially unobstructed knowledge, perception, energy, and bliss. And actually, absence of obstruction is also presented as an inner quality of the soul, which seems to be an emphasis on the fact that the restlessness associated with the presence of feeling, even pleasant feelings, is simply alien and painful to the souls that we really are. So we seek an absence of feeling because, to explain to you more precisely, the influx of karmic matter that includes sensation ultimately always depends on the first type of karma. And if you remember, the first type of karma is the delusory karma. So everything that we feel always ultimately depends from this delusion-producing karma. And that delusion-producing karma impedes one's insight and one's action. So interestingly, the inherent quality of the soul, which is affected by this delusion-producing karma, is not an obstructed knowledge, which we may have thought it would be, but it is unobstructed bliss. When we have this delusion-producing karma, what is affected is our bliss. But this bliss is not a feeling. This bliss is a state inherent to the soul's very existence, and the defiled state of unobstructed bliss, when mixed with this karma, this is what is called delusion. So this is, I want you to understand how this is a real physical transformation of the soul as a liquid may change into a solid. But this change can be undone thanks to religious practices. So before we see how, let me insist on this again. Delusion is the real suffering of the soul. Delusion is a condition of all our ordinary experiences, both pleasure and pain. Our current existence, if you will, is a kind of denial of our true nature. And bliss is accord with our own being. So this also implies that only someone with insight enough into the basic structure of reality is really aware of the unsatisfactory character of this existence. Real suffering is maybe not recognized by the ordinary man. Hopefully, Jain religious practices and philosophical treatises are here to help us realize what a real suffering is and to overcome it. So back to our main question, it seems that in this framework, the relationship between the self and karmic matter is to be thought of on the model of water and dust particles. So this metaphor is first found in a commentary to the Treatise on What There Is, and let me read it to you and then explain it a bit. So it says, just as the mud in water settles down when clearing nuts are put into it, so also the karmic matter does not manifest its power in the soul due to causes. So let's examine this more closely. But first of all, I would like to suggest a parallel with the process of sedimentation. So you know, a soul bound with karmic matter is like muddy waters. It is impure. One doesn't see through it so well. However, the clarity of the water can be gained again. And how? Because despite the mixed, water has never lost its nature. So if the muddy water is not stirred for a sufficient amount of time, then thanks to a process of sedimentation, the dust will settle at the bottom. And so water will be pure again, and one will be able to see clearly through it. So in this metaphor, for each mixture, the time and the modality of the disentanglement will depend upon the nature of the substances involved, as well as of the intensity of the mixing. And so it's exactly what happens with souls and bodies. Their type of entanglement in the previous life will affect the one in our current life. It's mechanical. So giants develop a very complex system with precise calculation to explain that. And what I really want us to retain from that today, two things, is that from this metaphor, the first thing which I found fascinating is that ethical and epistemic purity are linked. So by acting in a moral way, I actually also happen to have a better awareness of what really is. Because I stop acting clinging to my own intentions, you know. I finally have the mental space to see without this veil of my own desires and aversions and the like covering it. And so that's the first thing. Ethical and epistemic progresses are, you know, again, two sides of the same coin. And the second thing is that the soul belongs to its own domain and karmic matter to its own domain. The water never really lose its nature. The Jaina philosophers say that the same way that clay is the material cause of the pot, the same way karma is the material cause of bondage. While the potter is the efficient cause of the pot, the soul and the state of the soul are the efficient cause of bondage. So that's the way they interact, actually. Yes, so also if we go back in this to the excerpt, what we read is not, they don't describe an absence of movement and the process of sedimentation. No, they suggest the use of something which is called a clearing nut. So I don't know if you've ever heard of a clearing nut before. I had not before this text. So apparently the seeds of a nut called a kataka are traditionally thrown into water in order to purify it, because they have the ability to remove turbidity from aqueous solutions. So that seems to suggest that absence of movements might not always be enough to appease unquiet minds. We may need an active substances, especially like hearing the teaching of the Tirthankaras or seeing a statues of those liberated beings to have that effect on our soul. So we will come back to this, but already keep in mind that we need actually a transformative experience that gives us some right insight. And only this right insight will, from this, can we efficiently engage in the Jain path by becoming a monk or a nun. So we need to have some clarity already to start begging it. We need a clearing net, this transformative experience. So, yes, one last thing I wanted to tell you here. You have noted the difference between the quieting or the burning of karma here. Yes, you have states of the soul in which karma is just suppressed but still at the bottom, and you have states of the soul in which karma is totally destroyed. So ascetic practices and practice that we do everyday life will have one of or the second type of outcome. But so before we move on, I want to introduce you a last. So before we move on to the characterization of those practices and of the position of chimes in this world, from this metaphysics, see how it applies. There is another slightly different conception of the relationship between the self and karma that I would like to tell you about. Okay, and it's called the red crystal model. The works which are attributed to this thinker, Kunda Kunda, they are as important and as seminal as the treatise on what there is that we have seen for some communities, not all, and their practices. And Kunda Kunda is actually also actually not a single author, but a name that stands for the collective authorship of a giant textual traditions that is composed in Prakrit between the 3rd and the 8th century around Karnataka, so in the south of India this time. And Kunda's work, interestingly, are regularly worshipped as sacred texts in some temples. So, within this textual tradition, I will focus with you only on one, which is called the Samayasara, the essence of the self. And then, why do I do that? Because here, in this text, Kunda Kunda seems to have gone one step further within a metaphysical dualism, ready to separate the souls with everything else in the world. So, we have just shown that in the classical doctrine, the soul is affected by karma like muddy water by dust. So we need actually a physical change to get liberated. Now in Kunda Kunda, the soul is never really affected by karma. So from this, a strictly epistemic change will be enough to get liberated. So the metaphor used in that text is that of the red crystal. As surely as a pure crystal does not turn red by itself, but is colored by another red substance, so truly the pure knower does not become impassioned by himself, but by another impassionate, etc., disease. So to spell out this metaphor, when we see a crystal on which a red flower is reflected, we should not think that the crystal itself is red. And here there is a pun because raga, red in Sanskrit and Prakrit, means both red object and also attachment, passion. So we should not think that the crystal is red itself, only the reflection of a red object is there. And in the same way, the soul exists without really being in contact with passion and delusions, which are only in the pure view of karmic matter. Okay, so far so good. Let us stop the metaphysics and investigate a bit the practice. Okay, so as you can imagine, in the muddy water model, the idea is either to keep the karmic distortions as quiet as possible, so that we can really see clearly, or to burn the karmic particles altogether. And the karmic particles, again, here are symbols of the trace of the deeds which are carried out earlier. So that is the muddy water model, but in the red crystal model, the idea is to realize that those karmic distortions are actually not ours. Okay, so to achieve these aims, various methods have been put forward. And actually, in early Jainism, from Mahavira in the 5th, 6th century to approximately the turn, the second century before the common era, the turn of the common era, the goal was to put a stop to activity in a most radical way. The Jain ascetic really had to abstain from food and prepare for death in a position which was as motionless as possible. But as you can imagine, it would have been hard for these religious traditions to keep alive until today if this was the core teaching through the centuries. And by the way, also here lies a very important difference between Buddhism and Jainism, where Jains follow a more extreme path while the Buddha advocates a middle way. So what happens around the turn of the century of the common era? The goal is not to stop all activity anymore. No, the fight against karma at that time, and again, I want to rephrase the fight against karma by the fight against the bias of consciousness. That fight is ensured by withdrawing from activity which are driven by passions. We don't want to stop every activity, we only want to stop the activities which are driven by passions. and then we can really, sort out the bias of our consciousness, burn our karma. And so here, the ascetic, what is the goal of the ascetic? The ascetic trains himself or herself to master equanimity. Equanimity, that is to say, a state of mind in which we do not desire this or that. So a state of mind from which we will at least not create further karmic prints. So this is really what you have, I think, in most trends following yogic practices, yogic meditative practices, where yoga is the firm reins of your senses. So, and also in the background of these conceptions, you have something, the ascetic practices, the core spiritual activity of movement of renunciants, those activities are called tapas. And tapas means heat in Sanskrit. And so it's linked with the fact that when you practice, for example, when you practice a sport, you can feel a heat within. So that's what, part of the experience that is sought. And heat allows transformations in chemical processes, including digestion or cooking. And likewise, the karmic matter binding our soul can be burned with these ascetic practices that create such a heat. The monk or the nun should tolerate all type of hardships. So that's one practice, is to tolerate hardships and discomforts. For example, sitting in the sun without the protection of a clothes. And these practices are really oriented towards both creating heat and also mastering equanimity. Do not desire that, do not fear that. And fasting. Fasting is also a very important part of this heating and creating equanimity practices. Because fasting primarily consists of heating oneself, drying, thinning. Besides, it's also a form of sacrifice of the worldly self towards something which is more essentially ourself. So fasting is actually the religious activity which is the most familiar to all Jains today. All the groups practice fasts, regular fasts. And the second practice which is very important is that of meditation. Meditation has a special importance, both in movements following, if we can say, the muddy water model, and in movements following the model of the red crystal. And so here you have a quote on that. Meditating on the self which consists in perception and knowledge, and not on anything else. Meditating on the self, he very quickly realizes the self, which is completely free of all karma. So realize, again, realizes to understand and also to make it happen. So meditation is important for all Jains. It is based on the quietness of the mind, and also it leads to the quietness of the mind. And at the same time, it provides with an increased awareness of what really is. So, very briefly, I will just show you the different types of practices that are supposed to be followed. Jain manuals will especially provide many sets of practices to cultivate self-control. Self-control is the key term here. And these are still followed today. So monks and nuns, they have to undertake each of those practices. And also by the 13th century, there is an extensive literature also on how should a Jain lay person act. But the acts, the rules for the lay person really mirror the practices governing ascetic life, but only with less demands. But again, every rule for the Jaina layman or laywoman, they are really preparatory rules, preparatory exercise, because that will give you a better balance between good and bad karma. But if you really want to start quieting, letting the karma go on the very bottom of your soul, so to speak, or to burn it, you really have to be within the Jain path of the ascetic. So, we are going to see them very quickly, just to show you how some Jain practices are focused on self-control, and how only a continuous training will be will help you, will help each of us to reshape our habits. So you need a certain number of our rules. So very briefly, the monastic has those four types of rules to follow: the great vows, the rules of self-control, the restraints, and the obligatory duties. So the great vows are, you won't be surprised by that, non-violence. We should be essentially non-violent, and we will focus on that a lot. We should be truthful, we should not steal, we should be celibate, and possess as little as possible, up to the nudity of the monks in some traditions. Then you have rules of self-control, properly speaking, mindfulness in walking. You should walk, and you should always be mindful when you walk. I don't dare walking too much, because when you walk, you can crush a lot of microscopic organism. And you see that those monks, they all have a broom, so they can just wipe the floor before they walk, just to ensure they don't not killing anything. Mindfulness in speaking, in begging, they do beg for food. Mindfulness in receiving and in releasing. And then we have the three restraints: control of mental activity, vocal activity, bodily activity. So you see how each of your acts in everyday life has to be really restrained and mindful. And the obligatory duties is to practice equanimity, which means actually to stand in a motionless position for 45 minutes and reflect on equanimity, to worship the Tirthankaras, which are those liberated beings, homage the master, practice repentance very regularly. Every time you ask for forgiveness for having hurt a living being, and abandonment of the body and renunciation. And for the lay person, it's something very similar. I let you go through that, but a bit less. For example, they will not have to be as mindful as a monk and a nun when traveling. They won't be carrying the broom. They can even take the plane, but they should very be careful of stopping any excessive travel. Enjoyment also, and abandon any kind of deleterious activity. And the same. The four vows of instruction, as you can see, I think it's really focused on restrained action and mindful action, and it mirrors in a lesser way the big vows of the monks and the nun. And here you see the ceasing of a fast of a giant lay woman. So fasting is a very central practice. So you see how, I don't know if you have that feeling also, but these rules of action are quite similar from one to another. Each of these guidelines is really, the main point of it seems to be to act in a restrained way in order to cultivate mindfulness and to master self-control towards equanimity. So you also see an aspect that I have not touched upon in this lecture, but which is also very important for some jains. This is the devotional worship of the Tirthankara. Such a worship is actually also credited with the ability to destroy karma. Besides, another aspect I haven't touched upon, but keep it in mind, is important, is not in those texts. In some tradition, there is a ritual use of powerful diagrams with specific formulas to be recited, and those will ensure favorable results, including, of course, the removal of karma also. So now all these practices seems to go against an involvement of the jains in the matters of this world, don't you think? So, and yet, when you look at Jain communities today, what they do is very far from that. They are committed to a better situation of the world. They are committing to a lot of things. So I would like us to question that. The thing is that the main concerns of these practices that we have just very quickly scrolled through is indeed to ensure self-control, to guard against karmic influx, but to do so while taking into account a surrounding environment of which is really teeming with life forms. And this is what explains the presence of the practice of nonviolence within these rules. So let me focus now on this aspect, as nonviolence is the trademark of Jainism, so to speak. And so to do so, let me end where I started, stating that all Jain religious practices are directed towards overcoming the embodiment of the soul, because at the heart of Jainism is the belief that each living being, so you, me, that imperceptible bacterium that I should be careful not to crush when moving my hands, is a permanent soul, and that a soul is essentially this unobstructed, illimited knowledge. And so in such a scenario, I think it's pretty clear that the more I am aware of what really is, the less I let the filters of my passions hide from me what is essentially relevant in reality, the more I see that other living beings around me are like me. That is to say, divine-like entities in the making. And from this, it is quite clear that it is one's responsibility to avoid harming them. Actually, in Jaina, early texts, harmful acts are theorized as the acts which are causing the most bondage. So at least for our own sake, we should be mindful of the other living creatures around us. And so this has taken such an importance that I think you have it here. In 1974, the Jains adopted the motto Paraspara Graho Jivanam, which means the function of the souls is mutual support. And you have this in Devanagari here under the hand. That's the emblem of Jainism, and behind it, it is written the function of the souls is mutual support. And within the hand, it's written Ahimsa, and Ahimsa means nonviolence. You might have heard that in Gandhi, maybe, Ahimsa. So that's the motto, and this is the emblem of Jainism. This precise verse is actually introduced within the treatise on what there is, inside a section on metaphysics which describes the function of each type of substance. So the function of motion and rest is the support of movement, the function of matter is the support of body, speech and mind, the function of time is continuation, and the function of soul is mutual support. So I cannot stress enough the links between metaphysics and religious practices in this tradition. So with such a motto, it's no surprise, I'm almost done, that solidarity is actually prominent in contemporary Jain religious practice. Because as we said, avoiding binding new karma is also to realize that all living beings are essentially similar and should be treated accordingly. So all living beings, have a common duty and common goal. So that is really fostering a sense of community and of mutual assistance. So in contemporary Jainism, this means to be actively committed to the well-being of others. So many philanthropic projects are undertaken by the Jain laity, including large-scale projects like building hospitals. Secondly, the Jains, they consider that also animals and plants are like us, so solidarity towards that. I think that's a specificity of Jainism. They also construct hospitals for animals. And if you have been in India, in New Delhi, you have this hospital that you see in the picture for birds. And in contemporary societies, as you can imagine, this solidarity towards all especially means that one should actively combat the damages caused to animals and to the environment by the modality through which humanity populates the planet, so especially with extensive agriculture or the industrial model. So in order to start responding to this crisis, the Jains today, a lot of them are turning vegan. So they had a vegetarian diet, and now they are more and more becoming vegan. For example, the Jaina Center of Southern California was the big one starting that, and now more and more people are doing that, and institutions. So, more generally, the Jain insistence on restraint and mindful action does promote an ecologically friendly way of life, as you can imagine. We don't want to consume it too much. We are always, very mindful of what we do. That's really in line with that. And the well-known Hindu figures that is Gandhi is held by many as being India's first environmentalists. because of his nonviolent resistance, was a model for the first environmentalists. And interestingly, Gandhi was he always presented his conceptions of nonviolence as indebted to Jainism and to a Jain leader called Rajchandra. So, if you have followed this introduction, it's clear that Jain principles are not directed towards human beings, animals, and plants, but towards souls residing in those, which is a very different project, actually. So there are actually dissensions between the religious project of getting liberated and the environmental project of saving the planet. But at least these ancient norms of, and we can discuss examples of that in the discussion, but at least these ancient norms of action do promote a wisdom in harmony on many levels with contemporary considerations on the preservation of the environment. So in conclusion, Jainism is a plurimillenary tradition whose values are essentially compatible with current global values and has been skillfully adapted to contemporary contexts. Jains do not try to convert usually. There is no conversions in Jainism, but they wish to spread values deemed decisive today, especially nonviolence and constant awareness and vegetarianism and veganism, and also mutual aid. So these lines of practice are meant to achieve the universal duties of solidarity, thereby making an ethical way of life the surest way to be closer to the divine soul that we really are. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you for listening to the AKC podcast. If you have enjoyed this lecture, please click subscribe in your podcast app to receive future episodes. AKC, at the heart of King's thinking.